even though we're in a pandemic, the housing market is hot. Why? Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. It's true, housing sales are up and so are home values. We're going to look at how the pandemic has shifted the market and who's actually buying. We'll also look at the evictions moratorium. There's another extension, but how will the market correct as the pandemic continues? Also, we bring back an old voice at WLRN, former reporter Nadege Green. Her latest project is focused on archiving and showcasing the rich black history of Miami. And finally, and the only heart. We continue with season 3 of Live from the 305, our conversation with local jazz singer Nicole Henry, and we'll learn how she launched her career in Miami Beach. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Give you country walks. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Well, South Florida's housing market, guess what? It's hot. Sales and home values are climbing, and that's happening as we live through a pandemic. Now, the type of buyer has sort of changed as more Americans are moving here from the north and the west. But we're going to look at the current market for homeowners, and we're also going to look at it for renters as well. We're joined now by the Miami Herald reporters, Rebecca San Juan and Renee Rodriguez. Rebecca, Renee, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Luis.
Thank you.
Rebecca, let me start with you. You know what? We're going to hear pretty soon in the next few weeks, we're going to hear from mayors about the state of their cities and the economy still faltering because of the pandemic, but housing reacted really differently these last 12 months. What did you hear from experts when the pandemic was starting? What did they think was going to happen?
Oh boy, Luis. At the beginning of the pandemic, realtors were freaking out. They were like, oh my God, what's happening? You know, the issue was that we had gone off of such a great run in 2019. We had a healthy sales market, and come the pandemic, you know, what happened was that buyers and sellers, they said, you know, buyers weren't comfortable leaving and touring homes. And then sellers said that they didn't feel comfortable having people in their homes.
Right.
So it was a tough beginning.
Yeah. I remember as we were covering this story at the beginning as well, just that people just didn't want to go anywhere. So how could you sell a house? Renee, what are some of the other things you heard as the pandemic was starting? What the predictions would be for the housing market by the end of the year?
Well, no one had any predictions because no one knew. This was uncharted territory, right? This is a global pandemic. It wasn't happening just here. It was happening everywhere. People couldn't travel. People were losing their jobs. The economy was, you know, was tanking. And so there was a period of about a month and a half where everyone was just kind of holding their breath, waiting to see what was going to happen. Eventually in May, you start to see a little bit more gradual activity because the brokers got clever. They started doing home showings through, you know, Zoom, video showcases. Instead of having open houses, they would walk you through it with a video. And New Yorkers, people in large cities, especially New York, where the outbreak was particularly bad, really wanted to get out of there. And they wanted to go live somewhere where they weren't living on top of each other. So that kind of kickstarted the market here again.
Yeah. Rebecca, what are real estate experts saying is the reason why it turned out way better than expected?
Well, you had this tax flight, right, coming in prior to the pandemic. So what we saw prior to the pandemic was heads of companies like Carl Icahn saying, he said in September 2019, I'm moving because of taxes, right? They can save money here. But you know what the issue was? Companies didn't realize that their employees could work successfully from home.
Yeah.
And so what happened, what we started seeing is that CEOs, more heads of companies started moving down here. And they said, we're bringing our people with us. And so that's one thing, you know, remote working was really successful. Secondly, you have the tax savings. Third, you have the weather. And fourth, Miami, you know, Luis, in the last few years has become such a great city. You know, you have Art Basel, you have people not just from Latin America, but from everywhere living here. And so all of the buyers, realtors were saying, that's why, you know, there it's all of these reasons and all of these incentives working together.
Yeah. Renee, if I recall, Miami's housing market was a little bit overvalued and before the pandemic. And so I'm wondering, who exactly can afford to move here?
Well, that's a great question. The median sales price of a home in Miami-Dade County in November reached an all-time record. It's $450,000. Remember, that's a median sales price. That's not an affordable price for most people that I know. I think that's what we used to think of luxury as before. But what drives prices, of course, is always demand. And so you had people in condos who weren't crazy about the idea of living on top of each other, you know, being so close to their neighbors. And so they went out and they started buying homes. You had, like Rebecca said, the out-of-towners who were moving in here as well. And you had people who were just first-time buyers, and they were like, hey, the market is kind of slow right now, so let's just head out and buy a house. That escalated very, very quickly. And now we're in a situation where if you are looking to buy a single-family home in Miami-Dade or even Broward for less than $500,000, the brokers recommend that you put in a bid sight unseen and get your bid in first and then go look at it over the next 48 hours because it's not gonna hang around.
Oh my goodness. And but I mean and my understanding too, even Palm Beach County. So it's just South Florida is doing really well right now. You know, Renee, the other thing too is this, I mean, for a long time, you know, we had a lot of buyers coming in like from Latin America. Is that still the case, or does it seem like, you know, you got people from like New York and California getting out of those high tax states and now they're kind of moving in a lot more?
The Latin American buyers started slowing down. It didn't, like, they didn't go away completely, but they started slowing down with the Trump administration because of everything having to do with immigration, and nobody knew if they were going to be able to travel freely from the United States. So you started seeing that slowing down a little bit. One easy way to measure Latin American buyers, out-of-town foreign buyers, is by the number of cash transactions, because they tend to pay in cash. They tend to be wealthy, and they have a lot of money lying around. And so in November of 2020, 28% of cash transactions accounted for 28% of all total closed sales, which is down from last November when it was 35%. So you have seen a bit of a slowdown, but that's more COVID related, I think, than anything else.
Yeah, it is. If I can jump in here,
sure.
Realtors are saying that because of the pandemic, and if you're looking at countries, you know, across Latin America, they all have like their own travel restrictions.
Yep.
And so realtors are saying, like, we're not seeing the Latin American buyer as much. We're seeing a lot of people from Mexico, but we're not seeing like the amount of people we used to see from Argentina, Brazil. But they expect that with travel restrictions lifting, we have the vaccine. They're like, oh, we're really predicting that they're going to help even like increase the momentum and the sales activity that we're seeing today.
And, you know, as usual, again, South Florida in general, just it's a great place to move. It's nice and warm. And of course, you have a great view. And so you always had the outsiders moving in. And sometimes that put a lot of pressure on locals and what locals could buy. Rebecca, you reported not too long ago about younger buyers, the millennials, and a lot of them are leaving. That's still the case?
That is not the case. At least that's not what I'm hearing. When I reported on that story, that was in June by a study by Smart Asset. They saw that in 2020, you know, looking at from January through June, 2,736 millennials had moved into South Florida. And hear this, Louis, 6,368 people had left. So that was like a big number for us, and we were really concerned about that. But when I spoke to realtors for that story and even after, realtors said, you know what, this is normal because that age range, 25 through 39, you know, people might be leaving to, you know, for studies or for, you know, certain opportunities, but they'll come back. You know, what attracts a lot of millennials to Florida is the fact that it's, you know, a lot of small businesses start here, and that it's a great place to start a business. So that has attracted, since that report came out in June, a lot of millennials, and I haven't heard that millennials are leaving as much as when I reported on that story.
Do we know what it's doing, though, to the local home buyer? You know, for when it comes to buying, are they stuck not being able to compete for those homes, or do we see people leaving?
I think what you do, I think what you're seeing is a combination of those things. I think people, for example, one neighborhood where that has exploded in terms of sales, and you measure sales activity by property values, right? When property values are going up, that means more sale, more homes are being sold in that area, is Cutler Bay, which is, you know, depending on your commute, you know, it's pretty far south. However, working from home has made the commute less of an issue. So you would, people are willing to live a little bit further away from the urban corridor and have a, you know, be able to afford a house. There's a couple of projects in Homestead that are breaking ground that, that are going to be single family homes and townhomes. And again, you know, Homestead is almost like another state. It's how far away it is. But the thinking is working from home will make that, you know, just.
Renee, are we assuming that we're going to be working from home for a long, long, long time?
The thinking is, you know, nobody knows. Depends on your job, obviously. But, you know, what, and this is off the top, off topic a little bit, but, you know, you're seeing the tech companies, Twitter told its employees they can work from home for the rest of their lives. You're seeing even an institution like the Herald, you know, we covered a hurricane, we covered a presidential election, and we covered a pandemic, and we've been working from home since March. And I think, you know, it remains to be seen what's going to happen when things get back to normal. Yeah. But I can't imagine that some companies aren't going to say, hey, you know what, we don't need 10,000 feet of office space when we can only, when we only really need to use 4.
Yeah. No, that's an interesting point. You know, how many people will be able to stay at home and how that changes things. Again, we're talking about housing. And even though we're in the middle of a pandemic, housing in South Florida is on the rise. Sales are up. Home values are up. Why is that? Well, we've gotten a number of reasons. We're talking with Miami Herald reporters Rebecca San Juan and Renee Rodriguez. Rebecca, one thing I noticed that is down, rent. This was kind of expected, but what's happening?
So rent is down in a lot of cities. And, you know, what we're seeing is that people who had to live in downtown Miami, let's say, they're leaving. They're renting houses. They want more space. And so rents are going down in, you know, across Miami. We're seeing Doral in Broward, Fort Lauderdale. In order for landlords, what they're put in a tricky position here, because they're in some areas, for example, Sunny Isles Beach, there's an oversupply of units. And so they already had that pressure of like, I need to make my rent competitive because, you know, there's a lot more supply here. But now they're trying to keep the tenants that they have and attract more, because they're also competing against more, I don't want to say suburban markets, but more houses, which in the past was never, they never had to compete with, you know, with other areas besides maybe like the immediate area, where their unit, is located.
Does that mean the renter has more negotiating power right now?
Oh, yes. This is the time. I mean, if you want, if someone is thinking about, oh, I've always wanted to live and test out Sunny Isles Beach, Miami Beach, this is the time, because we really have seen major drops in these areas. Miami Beach, for example, we last reported saw a year-over-year dip of 3.1%. Right now, rents are, the median rent is at about $1,580. So this is like, if you want to test out the market, this is the the time to do so. But I should say, Lewis, some of these markets, like, for example, Sunny Isles Beach and Miami Beach, it's not like you're going to find the best deal there. The best deal, if a renter is like, I really need to find the cheapest place to live, well, that's going to be Lauderhill and Broward and Lake Worth. Lauderhill has a median rent of $1,150, and Lake Worth in Palm Beach County, going a little further, has a median rent of $1,100 per month.
And, you know, again, if we're working from home, might not be so bad if you're living a little further away. In the past, that kind of commute would have been hell. I'll just say it that way. It is what it is. Renee, I wanted to, you know, talking about rent, I wanted to ask about the eviction moratorium. I mean, we had a moratorium in place by the state. We had one by the CDC. Now, with this new stimulus package, there's one. But let's clarify what's really happening here and what renters, what's the deadline now?
So, yeah. So the current eviction moratorium extends through January 31st. Okay, that's the official date. There's no way that that's not going to get extended. Especially with the new administration and the funds for the stimulus package that was just passed in late December haven't even been distributed yet. So that moratorium is going to be extended. Each state is going to get a chunk of money. The stimulus package was a total of $900 billion, and $25 billion of that are for rental relief specifically. Florida is going to get $1.43 billion. And each municipality passes it out depending on how they want to do it. It's up to either the city government or the county government to figure out the mechanism. What's great about the relief funds is that they are only earmarked for people making 80% or less of the area's median income. So you can't be a freeloader and be like, yeah, you know what? I don't want to pay my rent. Give me some of that free money. You have to make, for a household of four people, you would need to make $73,000 or less to qualify. If you're one person, you have to make $51,000 or less to qualify for the assistance. And the other big change in this stimulus package that was not true of the last one is mom and pop landlords who are private individuals who own right. investment companies. They own almost half of all the rental units in the United States. And they will be able now to apply for the funds themselves as long as they can get the tenant to sign the document.
I see.
Why wouldn't the tenant want to apply on their own? A lot of people have, you know, work in the shadow market. They don't have W-2 forms. They don't want, you know, there are a lot of reasons why people haven't taken advantage of a lot of these funds. But this will be the big difference, which is going to help landlords.
So there was always, Renee, there was always that concern that, you know, when the moratorium is lifted, that there was just going to be a whole bunch of evictions. And the process of evictions is underway, but it's just, you know, again, the moratoriums have been trying to push that back. But is there really, should we have that fear that we're going to see a mass of people all of a sudden homeless?
Well, you've probably seen the headline, a tsunami of evictions is coming. But according to the Miami-Dade Clerk of Courts, I had them count. And from March 13th, which was the first day of the pandemic, through December 22nd, there have been a total of 1,890 writs of possession written. A writ of possession is the last piece of document in an eviction. That's the ones that the Miami-Dade police come to your house and say, we have a writ of possession, you need to vacate the premises. So there's only been 1,890 of those written, meaning that that eviction case went all the way to the end and the judge approved it. However, Miami-Dade police, which are the only ones who are allowed to carry out evictions, are still not carrying out evictions. I think what you have found is a lot of landlords have worked something out with their tenant. It behooves the landlord to keep their tenant instead of just vacating the apartment. And so they're taking partial payments. They're working things out. A lot of tenants, you know, used unemployment to help pay their landlords something. So you would think that number would be higher. But as of right now, it stands at 1,800, which is not a small number. But considering we've been at this for a year, I thought it would have been a lot higher.
Yeah. And of course, we have a new administration coming in, and the Senate, we don't even know, that may have turned, Democrat, so you don't even know what kind of stimulus packages, if more, will be coming down the road. But interesting what's going on in the Miami housing market. Maybe some good news considering everything that we've been through as we jump into 2021. I want to thank my guests, Miami Herald reporters Rebecca San Juan and Renee Rodriguez. Find more of their reporting, by the way, on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Rebecca, Renee, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lewis.
All right, still to come, we're going to hear from a familiar voice from WLRN who's working to find and protect Miami's Black history. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, you know, when you tell the story of Miami, you can't tell it without talking about the Cuban story or the Venezuelan story or the Haitian story or the Bahamian story. And one of the key stories to all of this is the Black story. One of the voices that's protecting those stories, finding those stories, collecting them, is a voice you know well. Nadege Green, she's the Director of Community Research and Storytelling at the Community Justice Project. You remember her from all her time here at WLRN. And by the way, she's also behind the Instagram account at Black Miami Dade, which we're going to be talking about. It is great to bring back Nadege Green. Nadege, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
My goodness, it has been a long time. It's great to have you back. I got to ask you about this. You were so vital here at WLRN to make sure that there was a lot of the stories and the history from the Black community was getting its equal time. Public radio tries, but at the same time, you know, sometimes we fall short. And you fought really hard to make sure. You wanted to continue doing that, though. You left, but you're still doing that storytelling.
Yes, I am. I'm a born storyteller. Like you know, people like, well, what is your calling? I am, like, I tell stories. And I interrogate and dig. And, you know, I think stories are important. It's, you know, narratives are important. It's how we get to know each other. It's how we understand each other. I think there is so much power in that. Oftentimes it is through stories that we heal. It is through stories that, you know, we feel called to action. And so I think that there is a lot of power in stories, whether in journalism form, whether through poetry or whether through, you know, writing in some other format or filmmaking. But I think stories are integral to how we exist and how we know one another.
Tell me how it's different for you now, though, with the Community Justice Project compared to being a reporter.
Well, I certainly don't have the deadlines the same way. I don't have the daily news deadlines, but, you know, at, you know, a big part of the work that I'm doing now at Community Justice Project, it very much is similar to the work I was doing in journalism, which is like, what are the stories in our community and how do we tell them? I mean, specifically at Community Justice Project, which for those folks who may not know, is a nonprofit that specifically works around organizing and supporting building power in Miami-Dade County around organizing. So we work on campaigns and with organizations that, you know, are fighting for immigrant justice. We work with folks who are working on housing equity and, you know, fighting, you know, for renters to have decent housing against slumlords and, you know, it just, and, you know, police violence, like just all, a lot of the information around justice and equality in Miami-Dade, Community Justice Project is behind and supporting a lot of the folks who are working on that here locally. And in all of that, right, there are stories and it is through stories and it is through those stories that we understand the issues, right? Whether we're talking about policy work or, you know, organizing to shift how people think or to educate, that all of those things are rooted in stories ultimately. And that is the stories of those who are directly impacted, that's the most important thing.
Tell us about this Instagram account, which, by the way, you were doing while you were here, right? The Black Miami Dade, at Black Miami Dade.
Yeah, so I started at Black Miami Dade while I was still working as a journalist at WLRN. And it started off for me, you know, I was born and raised here in Miami. I'm a Black woman in Miami. I love history. And I especially love like local history and local Black history. Like that is important to me. And, you know, I would be working on stories or personal research or even a story for WLRN, and I would come across different things. Maybe it didn't make it into a story, or it did make it into a story, but I was like, oh, I would love a place just to house some of like the historical tidbits that I would come across. And so that was like the genesis of Black Miami-Dade, because I know personally, right, that it is not really accessible, right? Black Miami-Dade history is not, you know, we don't have a museum, right, for Black folks in Miami-Dade County. You know, there aren't a lot of accessible places to find information about Black Miami-Dade and its history. And so this was just my effort, like my love letter to Black Miami-Dade. Like, hey, I found this like really cool photo, or, you know, like, look at this like great paragraph, you know, from the United States Civil Rights Commission from the 1980s. And so it kind of became a research notebook, a visual notebook. And folks started following, and I started getting messages from people in the community who were like, oh, I'm so happy this is here, or I never knew this, or I knew of this, but I didn't know this part of it. And ultimately, it's like, you know, how do we democratize information? How do we disrupt inaccessibility when it comes to archives and our history, especially when there has been a concerted effort to cover a lot of that history, or a lack of curiosity even to even document this history in meaningful ways? And so this is just like my little corner of the internet universe.
You know, as I'm listening to you, I was thinking about that conversation we had last year with FIU historian Marvin Dunn, and talking about, well, what are they teaching in public schools when it comes to that history? And, you know, it's so fascinating because there's so much, as you said, there's just so much they're not teaching. Do you see the Instagram account as accessing that younger audience maybe and reaching them to help them find that information?
Certainly, but I mean, not to give our public school system an out, like this should definitely be taught beyond Instagram.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, like, I mean, a caption and a photo does not do, you know, Black folks' history justice, right? Like that, this is a snapshot, but certainly our public schools and as an institution, right, should teach Black Miami-Dade history, should teach local Miami-Dade history. I mean, you can grow up in Miami and not know who Henry Flagler was, or you see buildings with names, but you don't know what those names mean or who these people are.
Exactly.
We have schools named after important people, and the kids who go to the school don't even know who their school was named after. And so we just do a really overall poor job, not just here in Miami-Dade, but across the country, teaching history accurately. And definitely teaching Black history, you know, not as an aside, not as something you just do for Black History Month or, you know, Haitian Flag Day or Caribbean, you know, Awareness Month, but year round, like we can do better and we should do better.
I wanted to come back to a story that you did here at WLRN, the Railroad Shop Colored Edition Neighborhood in Alapata. And you've continued that in your work, and going back to this Instagram account, it was fascinating because you had posted up a historical map. But tell me how that story has evolved now for you, now that you're not a reporter, but you're still pursuing it.
Yeah. So when I was working on the Railroad Shop Colored Edition story, this is a neighborhood in the 1940s that, you know, dozens of Black folks lived in, and the neighborhood was disrupted and demolished through eminent domain. The Miami-Dade County School Board and Miami took the property of these Black folks to build an all-white school, Alapata Middle. And Dr. Dorothy Bendross Mendenhall, who is a school board member, is one of the children who was displaced, evicted by the school board. And now she's a school board member. But in doing the research for that story, I spoke with Georgia Ayers' daughter. Georgia Ayers was a monument in Miami's Black community. And she had given me a map that her mom had a few copies of, and she let me have one of those maps. And on that map, it had like dots of like all the families that they had identified that lived in Railroad Shop, because there was a Railroad Shop Colored Edition family reunion every year up until probably like the early 2000s. And so they had mapped out like the different family names, like where they lived and, you know, different stores in the neighborhood. And I posted a copy of that map online on the Black Miami-Dade Instagram page. And a young woman reached out to me, and she was like, hey, my family, my grandma is from Railroad Shop.
Wow.
Is my family name on the map that you had, because the map was just like a small picture. It wasn't the whole map. Right. And I went down the list and I gave, and indeed her family's name was on there. Incredible. And I sent her a photocopy of it so that she could have it to show her grandma. And that was such like a touching moment. But also, again, you know, I think of, you know, I go back to dance because I'm a formerly trained dancer. And Alvin Ailey, whose birthday was yesterday, from the Alvin Ailey Dance Company, he would, one of his famous quotes is like, dance is for the people and should be given back to the people. And I very much feel the same around like history and information, that it is for, from the people and should be given back to the people, right? Yeah. That the idea of having information, of archiving, of being a holder of any of this is not to hoard it, right? Like not hoarding information for information's sake, but how do you give the information back to the community? And so for me, this is like my love letter to Black Miami-Dade, my thank you to Black Miami-Dade. And, you know, I've interacted with so many folks on the page who are like, you know, thanks for posting this, or like, I feel so proud to be from here. Thank you for sharing this bit of history, because memory is powerful, right? What does it mean to be a community that remembers?
Yeah. And listen, before we finish up here, I've got to get to, because you have multiple posts on that Instagram account about the great singer, Betty Wright. Tell us a little bit about her story briefly.
Betty Wright is Betty Wright. Like, how do you not know Betty Wright, right? She's from Miami, the queen of Miami soul. So she's been dubbed. But, you know, growing up in Miami, I actually went to school, middle school and high school, with Betty Wright's daughter, actor. And so I grew up seeing her at school, and she would come to our rehearsals in high school at Miami Northwestern High School. But she was a powerhouse. She's like the first Black woman to get gold on her own label. She created her own label. But, you know, people can find out about the prowess of Betty Wright as the musician and the powerhouse that she was. But I wanted to highlight her as like a local human who we love, a beautiful mentor to so many young artists in the Miami-Dade community, but also the international artists, and some of the biggest stars that we know have been mentored by Betty Wright. She was also a praying woman, a prayer warrior. She was very active in that way and with her spirituality. And she also loved fashion. And so there was like a tribute to her and her fashion on the Black Miami-Dade Instagram page, because Miss Betty Wright was always dressed. and she was, you know, she recently went to meet our ancestors this past year. She passed away. But, you know, again, like, how do you grow up in Black in Miami and not know? I mean, so many people were like, I didn't know Betty Wright was from Miami. I'm like, she lived right here. She was at the school meetings at Miami Northwestern, you know, screaming at, you know, the performing arts and visual arts kids in Payback, you know, to dance full out and give it all you got in our production of Dreamgirls. And what an honor it was, right, to have the Betty Wright sitting in your rehearsal. But like that she is from Miami, right? She is a Black woman from Miami who loved Miami and who loved Miami youth especially. And so I wanted to talk about that and to talk about her mentorship and her impact here in Miami-Dade, because she gets all her flowers from the national community and the national artists and celebrities, but she should get her flowers here. So though I am not an elected official, I did declare the week of December 21st Betty Wright Week, because I said so. There were so many folks who were just posting their love letters to Betty Wright, who knew her, whether it was through the local schools, who knew her, you know, through church, who knew her through her Bible studies. But that she was part of our community, and that, you know, she was a giant in our community, and we need to honor our giants, we need to honor our elders, and we need to honor Black Miami-Dade and everything that comes from it.
And please check out those photos and those stories at on Instagram at Black Miami-Dade. Nadege Green, again, she's the Director of Community Research and Storytelling at the Community Justice Project. Also, by the way, check out, go to our social media, WLR and Sundial, because if you didn't hear, you know, that original series that I was talking about, the Railroad Shop Colored Edition Neighborhood in Alapata, go back and listen to it, please. You have to check that out. Nadege, such a pleasure. I got to have you back soon.
Thanks for having me, Lewis. Enjoy your deadlines.
I will. Thank you. Oh, my goodness. Great to talk to an old friend. Well, still to come, the incredibly talented jazz singer Nicole Henry in our latest installment of Live from the 305.
like this. You are tossing you.
For the past two decades, Nicole Henry has been a mainstay in the Miami jazz scene. Three of her albums have landed on the U.S. Billboard Top 10 list, and she's performed in festivals and concerts across the globe. Nicole's music exudes love and positivity, and she's focused on raising the voices of others. Her 8th annual Winter Gala concert this past December raised funds for the Miami Music Project. Nicole is continuing to perform concerts virtually, and her new single, Feeling Good, will be out this February. I spoke with her back in November as part of the latest installment of WLRN's Live from the 305, showcasing South Florida musicians shaping the music scene. You know, Nicole, the first thing I wanted to ask you was, do you remember the first jazz song you ever heard? And was it live or on record?
Oh, wow. Okay, I can remember the first jazz tune that I heard when I was going into becoming a full-time singer. And a friend of mine gave me Billie Holiday's album, Lady in Satin. And that, if you know Billie Holiday's career, that was her last album that she ever recorded, which means she was quite affected. To beat the band.
Look at yourself. Do you still believe the rumor that romance is simply grand?
And, you know, and I'm thinking, oh, I'm going to become a singer and I'm going to do this. I'm like, oh, you should listen to jazz. So I listened to this album and I'm like, that's not what I want to do. I was like, no, I don't have that. I have nothing to do with that genre of jazz, you know, because I didn't really consciously know jazz. And here I am in my early 20s, not knowing, I'd never really heard jazz. So I was like, no, I don't need to know anything about jazz, you know, even though I had grown up watching Billie Holiday, you know, Mahogany or Lady Sings the Blues, but I just didn't connect to it as an adult. And then the second CD that I got was actually a Nina Simone CD, and her voice sounded just as affected. And I was like, I don't understand these women's voices. Like, where these women are so in so much pain. I don't get it. And then I went on and was doing like original music and pop music and stuff like that. But it wasn't until I heard jazz live that I actually understood Billie Holiday and Nina Simone. So that's one of the reasons I just champion live performances and, yeah, appreciate live music
so
clubs.
So what were your influences growing up musically? I mean, what's the kind of stuff that you were most attached to?
Well, one that I can like hear it now, waking up on Saturday mornings and Sunday mornings, my mom used to study piano as a high school and in college. And so she was a concert pianist, so we had a live piano in the house. So I would hear my mom playing Tchaikovsky and Beethoven and so forth. And then she'd go on to putting the albums on. So I love classical music. But then 2 hours later, we'd be jamming to the Commodores and the Spinners. You know, my mom loved that 70s, 60s music. So I definitely grew up swinging out with my mom dancing in the living room to the Spinners and, yeah, Commodores and a little Earth, Wind & Fire, Aretha Franklin.
So it wasn't until basically your late teen years into your early 20s when you really started thinking about jazz.
Yes. I was shocked when I saw my first jazz performance. It was at Jazz It, right on 13th and Washington Avenue, and that was there. They had jazz Sunday, Monday, Tuesday nights, and I'm sitting there going, oh, okay, that was Frank Sinatra. Oh, okay, that's Cole Porter stuff. All right, I get it now. I get it.
Give me a sense of, you know, when you were getting going, you know, in especially in Miami Beach, what was the music scene like when you started? What was going on?
It was so thriving. There was just so much going on. let's see, 1998. I think that was about when I started, 97, 98. And so there was the Marlin Hotel that had like the music nights and open mic nights from Wednesday nights, Friday nights, they'd have live bands there. So there was always something to do. There were Senior Frogs. There was even Roses. There was some place on Biscayne Boulevard and 34th that Sean Birdman used to promote. You know, Neil Lara was in town. I mean, I wasn't performing back when Washington Square was open, really, but I remember sliding in there one time. I actually had a gig when I was in the University of Miami Gospel Choir. I sang background for an artist there, but I wasn't old enough to really get in. But yeah, the scene was so vibrant, and there was open mics, and there was just a whole community of like original music. And I remember recording my first demo in my studio. My friend like bought his home studio into my place, and with the percussion and the guitars, and I was playing guitars, and I had a 4-track recorder, a cassette recorder, and it was such a great scene. I even was in an original music band in 2000. Yeah.
You know, I was wondering, I mean, you know, you've had the chance to travel around the world. I mean, you've been to, you know, New York, you've been to Madrid, you've been to Tokyo, you've been all over the place. I'm wondering, why do you keep coming back to Miami?
It's like a magnet for me. I love it. And I feel like this is my hometown. I mean, I was born in Philly and raised in Bucks County. But when you come here, when you're 17, and I've lived on and off the beach since 1993. Did I just age myself? Okay, wait. So I just feel like like it's home to me. I grew up here. You know, you go to college, we used to hang out and party here. And I worked at a nightclub here on the weekends from 97. I opened up the Delano in 1995. David Barton Gym, the China Grill.
Would you do it the same way? I mean, you think about musicians, and I guess the idea, whether it's acting or music, there's always that idea that, well, if you want to make it, you got to go to New York or LA or Chicago or something like that. But I mean, are people coming here? Are they seeking out the Miami scene? Would you do it again the same way?
You know what? I don't regret anything. I do know that right after college, I was going to move to New York and really go for acting in 98 and live with my aunt in Brooklyn. But it just worked out that I wound up staying in Miami. And you know, I think if it's meant for you to do what you're supposed to do, it's going to happen wherever you are. And I mean, I think going to New York is a great idea. And I was living back and forth in New York for the last 4 years, actually. And but I always I've been playing in New York steadily since 2008. But I actually believe that New York has, Miami has just as much talent and great talent. I think a lot of the people here could survive in New York as long as they know how to hustle. But I think whatever's meant for you is meant for you.
You said something interesting. You know, you talked about hustle, and I always think about, I mean, that's something so unique to, I mean, I think about all the places I've lived, but there's something so unique about South Florida, especially Miami, is kind of like that mentality that people bring from the Caribbean and from Latin America is that hustle. You just got to work. And so that shaped you, right? That had to have shaped you a lot.
Yeah, I think, and you know, I appreciate you asking me this. And just earlier this week, somebody mentioned something of the same to me, like who would you attribute your worth ethic or your, you know, your drive. And I really just have to say, I think it's my mom and maybe just part of whoever it is that I am. I mean, my mom raised my sister and I after my parents got separated. She was a single mother and she'd sometimes work in 3 jobs. You know, she had her master's degree but she just always worked, but always was giving and loving and so much common sense. I mean, I think it was just like, you got to do what you got to do. If you want to get something done, you got to do it yourself. You know, don't sit around and, yeah, and she took no excuses. That was my mom too.
Let's go to your acting, because you know you've also done quite a bit of acting. It started with commercials, right?
That's right. That's right. Out of college, I was like, all right, I got to get my head shot. I had a job out of college for the Recording Academy, which is the organization that does the Grammys. So I was their executive assistant for 3 years. So I learned a lot with that organization. But then when I left that job, I was like, all right, I got to figure out how to make a living. And I knew I wanted to get into acting, so I took headshots. And then the only work that was really down here in Miami at that time were commercials and industrials, where you're like reading teleprompter and stuff. And I loved it all. I love a stage. I love script. I love copy. I love voiceovers. I love the whole thing. So I started doing a ton of commercials. Yeah. And then I got my SAG card. I got my first national commercial maybe a couple years into it. And yeah, I got maybe 5 or 6 national commercials, something like that, in my resume. So that was a blessing.
So I'd imagine is there a crossover? Because for you, is it just, it's just performance then, whether it's on a stage or you're singing or acting, is it just the performance for you?
Kind of. Yeah. For me, I love relating to people. And so, you know, give me dialogue that can allow people to feel and connect. Give me lyrics that allow me to feel and connect or help somebody get closer to me. Or even give me a stage or give me a voiceover commercial. And it's like, yeah, girl, you know, buy this burger, you know, whatever it is. I'm totally into communicating with people and letting them feel like you have a friend in me.
Well, I think about, for example, like if you're in a studio, so you're usually by yourself. Maybe there's a director in the other room talking to you. So there's that, but then that compared to like being on a stage. And even then, like when you're on a stage and you're performing, there's the fourth wall. So you're not really, you're disconnected. Where you're singing, you might be singing to people right in front of you. So there's a lot of difference here, is what I'm trying to get at.
It is. And it's
is there one you enjoy more than another?
Well, singing is definitely more immediate. And that's, I literally could sing on a corner, you know, for example, in New York City on the train station and connect with people. I think it's something that people immediately respond to. Like if I'm standing there and, you know, giving you a monologue, soliloquy, people would be like, this girl's out of her mind. So I think singing is definitely the most immediate.
And a promise to be near each time. You come, and the only heart I own is for you and you alone. That's all, that's all. I can only give you country walks.
And to me, there's something about singing, it's like classical music. You know, you have this fabric of a story where it has its highs and its lows, and it gets bigger, and then you can bring it back in. And it's just like, you can scream, or you can just love and caress stuff. So I think singing might be my favorite. But to me, acting is the most challenging. And so there's something about that I love too.
I think about the last time we talked, it was back in the summer. And we didn't have enough time to talk about this. And I wanted so much to ask you about, you know, how the issues going on in the country affect your creativity as well. You think about everything that's happened, the social strife, the protests, the Black Lives Matter movement. Now we have a new president, but that's also just this challenging time. The country seems really divided. All this is going on. And I'm wondering how that, as an artist, how you're taking all that in and how that's impacting your work. Because I know you're working on some new stuff.
Yeah, you know, it has definitely been depressing and like frustrating, meaning that, and when I get frustrated, I silence because I almost want to cry. And I get so like, I don't know what the answer is. Like, I always feel like I have to have the answer. I didn't know what to do. Like, it's just been really upsetting, the whole divisiveness and the lies, you know. I think both sides, you know, when I say, you know, blue and red, all of us were probably like, how do you think the way you think? And it's so upsetting, but we can't sit and talk because we're so far apart, you know, with the pandemic. But it definitely, like, there are times when I was like on social media and I want to be hopeful and optimistic. And then there are times when I'm just like, I don't know what to say because I just don't want to be frustrated. So, yeah, it's definitely been painful and disappointing. Yeah.
Let's talk about your new single. It's called Feeling Good.
That's right. It's the Anthony Newley song. I want to say, no, it's not from a musical, but Nina Simone made it popular. Michael Bublé's covered it. My favorite, George Michael's covered it. So my band and I have had this arrangement of it for years now. And we're like, let's put it down. And so we actually went into the studio and recorded three singles that were like really optimistic. And then we were going to release this song called Whenever I See Your Smiling Face in March. And then the pandemic happened, and it was like, nope, we don't want to see anybody's smiling face right now. Wear your mask. So that release didn't happen. And then Feeling Good, it was still hard. It was like, okay, when is the right time to release Feeling Good? Because we're, you know, there's so much devastation around us and craziness. But you know what? I thought with the new year, the idea of a new hope of, you know, change is coming. We thought that was going to be a good time to release Feeling Good. And we hope everybody appreciates it.
And that is award-winning jazz musician Nicole Henry. We'll have more of her music available on our website later today, so check it out. Her new single, Feeling Good, will be out in February. And that's our program for this Wednesday, January 6th. Coming up tomorrow on the show, sex trafficking of young women remains a critical problem in South Florida. The pandemic has forced a lot of the recruitment and solicitation online. Christie's House is focused on protecting these young girls. We'll find out more of what they're doing. Plus, we're going to learn about a controversial new lake that's being built in Palm Beach County. Neighbors don't like it. They think it's being used for one thing. The owner says it's being used for another. We'll find out what the controversy is. And finally, with remote working, do you find yourself sitting a lot? Are you getting up and being active? How to work at home and stay in shape. We'll talk about all of that coming up tomorrow on the program. I'm Luis Hernandez. As always, thanks for listening. Stay safe. Be good to each other. We'll talk to you live tomorrow.